This is the BAMA Podcast with Marty Solomon. I'm his co-host Brent Billings. Today I'm with Reed Dent to mull over the words of Psalm 32.
Psych! Let's actually start. We're going to start by talking about Psalm 51 a little bit. we'll get to 32, I promise.
We just talked about it last week.
We did. And I want to do a little bit of review because Psalm 51 is going to factor into our conversation on Psalm 32, because what I want to talk about is how I think these psalms are actually related, maybe even closely related. So we'll get to that. But let's start with Psalm. So last week we talked about Psalm 139 and Psalm 51. And what we talked about was just noting the relationship of those psalms to one another and about how we can see David as kind of being at both ends of the spectrum of just human experience through Psalms 139 and 51. For example, in Psalm 139, you get him saying, "You knit me together in my mother's womb." And then in Psalm 51, you get him saying, "Surely I was sinful from birth. Mm-hmm. In sin, my mother conceived me." And you remember we talked about some of our... There are some theologies about original sin and stuff that people use this Psalm 51 to as a foundation for, but that doesn't really play when you think about Psalm 139 as well. And really, it's just an expression of a personal experience, you know, just of being. And then in the one hand, you've got just immense guilt and regret and horror. David experiencing that when he kind of realizes or sees fully his own capacity just for wickedness. And then on the other hand, in Psalm 139, you've got just the sheer wonder and delight, and I would even say gratitude, just at being, at recognizing I am a creature who is lovingly handmade by God, and that both of those things are going to be true in each person. We all have those capacities. We all have moments, I think, where we realize acutely one of those feelings or another. And then we also talked about, I want to put a pin in this for a second. We talked about the use of the theme of hiding in those two psalms as a way of looking at this very important movement in David's relationship to God. So in Psalm 139, you had him saying, "My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place." And then in Psalm 51, you have him saying, "Hide your face from my sin."
Yes.
So in other words, on the one hand, you've got this expression or this picture of total comfort, total security in being fully seen by God, even seen by God at your most vulnerable moment, as you are completely, I mean, a child that is being knit together in the womb is completely dependent, completely helpless. And also, I would point out that there is actually a sense of hiddenness. A child being knit in the womb is hidden from the world. And that's kind of the fun of pregnancy, is you keep wondering, what is this child going to look like? And everybody's wondering, and you don't know until that child actually emerges. Mm-hmm. And yet, he says, in reflecting on that, "I wasn't hidden from you. You saw everything about me." And I think there's this feeling that's being communicated of goodness, of comfort in that. But then in Psalm 39, in Psalm 51, you have David communicating, and I think this is something that a lot of us can relate to, a very strong urge when he says, "Hide your face from me," a very strong urge not to be seen by God at all. "I would rather you don't look at me right now, because it's all the ugly stuff that is what's being on display." And so just we talked about how being visible to God can be either a comfort or a terror, depending.
Yeah.
So I wanted to put a pin in that because I want to return to this hiding theme a little bit later through Psalm 32.
Okay.
But I want to start with Psalm 51 and just again recall for us the context that that comes out of, which is, if anybody's got their text in front of them and they're looking at Psalm 51, you'll see right there at the top, it is not a secret, Which event, which specific event in the life of David does this psalm center around, Brent?
Yes, so helpfully laid out for us. When the prophet Nathan came to David after David had committed adultery with Bathsheba.
And I bet a lot of our listeners are familiar with this story. I mean, this is a classic. It's a classic from the Bible, and it should be. I mean, it's an incredible story that is, well, let's just recap it a little bit. So this takes place in 2 Samuel chapter 11 and into chapter 12. And hit me, Brent, with just what you remember about this story.
Well, they're in a wartime situation, and David is back at home, and he's just walking around, apparently not doing something because he has time to wander around and notice other people who are there, and notices Bathsheba, and
he does notice her,
calls her to him, and I guess it's a pretty condensed portion of the story. Mm-hmm. Like within two verses. It says, David sent messengers to get her. She came to him, and he slept with her.
Wow.
Then she went back home. The woman conceived and sent word to David, I am pregnant. That's two verses.
That is some efficient economy of storytelling right there.
Yeah.
It kind of reminds me, just as a throwaway, this reminds me of how in the Gospels, like when you get to the Passion narrative and Jesus is crucified, and they crucified him. It just happens like that. It doesn't go into, we know details about crucifixions from historical accounts, but it just kind of is like, and this happened. And it's like the biggest event that happens. So anyway, yes. Okay. So that happens. She gets pregnant, and this is particularly a problem. Why, Brent?
Well, because she is married and her husband is a soldier fighting under David's command.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I'm actually just looking at this, shocked at how insignificant it is, the actual adultery, and how substantial it is, the portion with Uriah and the deception and the...
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, his plotting and planning to cover it up. Like, that part is a huge portion of the story. And the actual adultery is just like, yeah, a couple verses.
Well, and when we get to what Nathan has to say, the parable that Nathan has to say is clearly about Uriah. It's not about Bathsheba.
Yeah.
Okay. And so this is actually, I want to tell this part because this is the most kind of Godfather. I love the Godfather. I love just the diabolical machinations when they're just orchestrating things and then it comes together in this really devastating way. And so Uriah, being a soldier of David's, is sent into battle, but David sends a note to the commander or whoever is there that says, everybody go forward with Uriah to the front of the battle, but then everybody withdraw, just don't tell Uriah you're going to do that. And so Uriah is just left completely alone out there. And of course, he is killed. And that way, David kind of cleans up his problem with the husband. And now he can move on with his life and his child that is coming from Bathsheba. And that's the end of the story, right, Brent?
Not quite.
David does not actually get away with it because Nathan, which is a word that I have messed up in Hebrew lessons enough now that I won't forget it anymore. It means gift. So this gift from God comes to David, and he's like, yo, I got a story to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
And he tells David this story about a poor little farmer who has his one little lamb. Is it a lamb in the story specifically?
Yeah, lamb or ewe lamb? I don't even know.
A ewe lamb. And then you got this big, powerful, is it named as a king in the story, or is it just like a rich neighbor?
A rich man.
A rich man who has just endless flocks is like, you know what? I really want that one though. And he goes and he takes this precious lamb from this poor farmer and he kills it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then Nathan is like, well, what do you think about that, David? And David's like, dude, I would I don't remember exactly what he says. I didn't look at it before we recorded this episode.
As surely as the Lord lives, the man who did this must die. He must pay for that lamb four times over because he did such a thing and had no pity.
Which is one of those classic, ironic, sort of unintentional self-sentencings that happens in some of our biblical stories where you say something not realizing the peril that it's going to put you into.
The next person to walk through that door is going to die. Whoops, it's somebody I love.
Exactly. And it's like, wow, we humans really have a way of digging ourselves into some holes in our righteous indignation. We really create some problems for ourselves.
Yeah.
And so he says, this guy should die. And then Nathan says one of my favorite lines in all of the Bible, which is what, Brent?
You are the man.
No, not like that. You are the man.
Yeah.
You said it a little bit like, you're the man.
Well, I don't know. What, I thought that's why you liked it so much.
No.
Yeah, no, I understand. I understand what Nathan is getting at. You are that man.
Yeah, you feel the fire in his belly, and he is now the indignant one saying, you're the one who did this. And David is undone. And then on top of that, Nathan says, yeah, this baby that you have conceived is actually going to die. I don't remember exactly how it phrases it, but how does it say it there, Brent?
I got distracted because I'm reading the, I love this line. You killed him with the sword of the Ammonites.
Oh, yeah.
Which I just like, I've been thinking about this a lot since I read Cross Vision by Gregory Boyd.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about the intentions of God. Like, did God actually say that? Or did God actually do that? Or did God like step back and let somebody else do it? Or did God not actually say it? And like whoever is in the story, like assumed that God wanted them to do that or whatever. And I think that is like the same. This is like a similar sort of idea. It's like, no, you did it. You did it through the sword of the Ammonites, but you killed him, which I just, yeah. Okay. What was the part you were having me look for?
What is it exactly that Nathan says when he tells him that the baby is not going to live?
David says, I've sinned against the Lord. And Nathan replied, the Lord has taken away your sin. You're not going to die. But because by doing this, you have shown utter contempt for the Lord, the son born to you will die.
Which I'm going to leave like the difficult discussion surrounding that aside for the time being. I just want to point out that this is the arc of this story, that it ends with this tragedy of the baby having to basically bear David's own sin, the consequences of David's sin. And then, of course, there's another baby that comes who is Solomon, who will become king. He is from Bathsheba, and that's kind of the end of that whole thing. Okay, so here's David, who has been confronted by Nathan and has just, one, had to face really his own wrath because he was the one saying, that guy should die. And then he realizes, oh, wait, that's me. And then on top of that, has just received this horrible news that his child is going to have to bear the consequences of his own sin. And now let's imagine, Brent, David sitting down to compose Psalm 51 for a second. So in proximity to the events of that we just talked about, to that whole story, when do you imagine that David is writing it, and what state do you imagine him being in?
I mean, it's almost like Nathan's still there in the room when he's writing it.
Mm-hmm.
The way that it is labeled at the top.
Yeah. When the prophet Nathan came to, oh yeah, I didn't even think about that.
And even you see it in 2 Samuel, David says to Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. And I can imagine like that portion. David says, I've sinned against the Lord. Nathan replied, the Lord has taken away your sin, but the son born to you will die. And then the next verse, it just says, after Nathan had gone home. But when did he go home? Like, it's almost like he was still sitting there and David is just spiraling. Like, oh, I've sinned against the Lord. And then you continue into Psalm 51. Have mercy on me, O God.
Verse 4, against you, you only have I sinned.
Yeah.
So what do you just imagine, like what are some adjectives that you would use to describe the state that David is in as he is writing this?
Utter despair, mm-hmm. Overwhelming guilt, I mean, he just feels like it's all over.
Do you know that? I think a lot of people describe it this way when they have similar experiences. When you've been confronted with and you realize kind of the depth to which you have made a mistake or harmed somebody, a lot of people describe it as a pit in the stomach. You know, that sinking feeling is very specifically, I think, related to guilt a lot of the time. And I imagine that David is probably feeling that. And I agree with you. I think he is right in the thick of it. I like the, you know, the sort of hyperbolic image of Nathan being there and David just having to like pour this out as Nathan is there with him. But whether it's, you know, that very day or sometime very soon, very close to this event, I think he's still, I mean, look at the language. There are a bunch of commands throughout Psalm 51 imploring God to act right now. Have mercy, wash away, cleanse me. Let me hear joy, hide your face, create in me, restore to me, deliver me, open my mouth. All of these are do this now. This is what I want right now. And then beyond that, there's just the tone of the thing, like you said, it just very clearly is dripping with guilt. It's dripping with despair. It is dripping with grief, I think. So I think, yes, this is right now. Unfiltered, which is why I think you get the line about surely I was conceived in sin. I was born in sin. Surely this is all I have ever been is basically what he's saying. And yeah, of course he feels that way as he's being confronted with the horrors of his actions. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now, finally, this episode is not about Psalm 51 exclusively. It is also about Psalm 32 that is in the title. So, Brent, let's go ahead and this is the right time. Let's bring in Psalm 32.
Of David, a maskil. Have you learned what that means or what that might mean, Reed?
I looked it up in Alter, and he says that it's ambiguous, I think. Actually, here, let me pause for a second because I did actually look at this.
Well, okay, so the NET footnote says, you know, the meaning's uncertain. Well, I think most Bibles have a footnote that say like, oh, it's probably a literary or musical term. Mm-hmm. The NET actually translates it as well-written, a well-written song. Because they say it's derived from a verb meaning to be prudent or wise. And so you have a few options like a contemplative song or a song imparting wisdom or a skillful or well-written song. And, you know, it occurs in quite a few psalms, but...
I think it's ambiguous. Here is what Alter says. He says that it's clearly a category of song, but that its precise nature remains unknown.
Okay.
I could have, yeah. So, you know how we're going to find out what sort of thing it is by just, we're going to read it. We're going to experience it right now, and then we're going to know.
Okay, perfect. Blessed is the one whose transgressions are forgiven, whose sins are covered. Blessed is the one whose sin the Lord does not count against them, and in whose spirit is no deceit. When I kept silent, my bones wasted away through my groaning all day long. For day and night your hand was heavy on me. My strength was sapped as in the heat of summer. Then I acknowledged my sin to you and did not cover up my iniquity. I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord. And you forgave the guilt of my sin. Therefore, let all the faithful pray to you while you may be found. Surely the rising of the mighty waters will not reach them. You are my hiding place. You will protect me from trouble and surround me with songs of deliverance. I will instruct you and teach you in the way you should go. I will counsel you with my loving eye on you. Do not be like the horse or the mule, which have no understanding, but must be controlled by bit and bridle, or they will not come to you. Many are the woes of the wicked, but the Lord's unfailing love surrounds the one who trusts in him. Rejoice in the Lord and be glad, you righteous. Sing, all you who are upright in heart.
My first question, Brent, is does this psalm seem different at all to you? They're both talking about sin, but how does this psalm, Psalm 32, seem different to you from Psalm 51? Does it have a certain character or qualities that make it feel different to you?
Well, I think it's recognizing what the Lord has done and not demand that he do all these other things.
Correct. Yeah, there's not those. There are no imperatives given to the Lord. It is, I would say that this is much more reflective.
Mm-hmm.
So it begins, the first two verses begin with a beatitude, which is kind of, where he says, blessed is the one whose transgressions are forgiven. He's speaking from experience. This is looking back. The tense, the middle two stanzas that go from, so verses 3 and 4, and then verse 5, those are all in the past tense. He is remembering something that happened. He is recalling. And then it ends with this section of just teaching, which feels a little bit unpsalmic. We'll get to that a little bit later. But just for now, when we're talking about the differences from Psalm 51, note that there is this section of 5 verses or so at the end that is just teaching to whoever the reader is.
Mm-hmm.
But are there things that feel similar to you at all from Psalm 32 and Psalm 51? Do you notice any commonalities?
Well, there's that idea of hiddenness that you were talking about before. Whereas before it was like in Psalm 51, it's a self-protecting thing. Like, hide your face from me. Like, I can't. Like, there's also immediately after that, there's that pleading, like, don't cast me from your presence. Mm-hmm. But there's also that, like, at the same time, like, don't even look at me because everything's terrible.
Isn't that interesting?
In Psalm 32, he's like, you are my hiding place. You will protect me.
Yeah, let's start there. I love that you are bringing that up. There is the hide your face from my sins, and then you are my hiding place. And if you remember, there in Psalm 139, as I had said at the beginning of the episode, in that one, it is, I was not hidden from you. And so I think it's interesting to observe a movement. If we locate in Reed's imaginary timeline, if you imagine these psalms coming in a chronology, if we imagine Psalm 139 as an early psalm, where there is a, you know, just like we already said, it feels orienting to use that scheme that we've talked about throughout the series. We are being rooted in the fact that we are known and seen by God. And then there is a movement into hide your face from my sins. I totally failed, and I don't want to be seen by you now in the midst of the Bathsheba incident. And then I imagine Psalm 32 as a later one that is kind of like, after being, I've been confronted and I'm choosing not to ignore that. I'm accepting the consequences of that, and I'm maintaining my hope in God as I'm processing all of this. And now that theme of hiding comes back in Psalm 32, and God is now the place in which my whole self is hidden. So I wasn't hidden from you. Then I wanted you to hide from me. And finally, I hide in you. Or you can even think about it as a movement from, I wanted to be protected from you, but now my protection is in being in you. And then even look at speaking of hiding. So what's our favorite game to play with our kids, Brent?
Hide and seek.
And you seek something so that you can
find it.
Exactly. And so in verse 6 in Psalm 32, there is this exhortation to let all the faithful pray to you while you may be found.
Mm.
And so David is now teaching everyone. He's saying, don't hide and don't ask God to hide, but rather pray to God while God can be found. And I think, you know, sometimes there is a thought that is, well, if there's only a time that God may be found, then at some point in the future, is God just going to arbitrarily decide, you know what, you can't find me anymore? like there's a timer on this, you know, and if you don't hit it, if you don't find me by the deadline, sorry, your chance is up and you're hopeless now. But I actually, when I think about the flow of these psalms, what I really hear it saying is that what is going to make God unable to be found is when we insist on pushing him away. And so what we're being told to do is don't hide. Let God be your hiding place, and then you will always find him. But when, and David's like, I know this from experience, when you say, hide you, God, hide your face from me, well, then he may be unable to be found if we keep saying that and keep saying that, and that just becomes a way of life for us. Okay, any other, there's a couple others that I see, a couple of other maybe common points. Do you notice any others?
Well, I'm just thinking of my own, you know, timeline of events here. And if I'm thinking back to 2 Samuel, you know, this is, you know, he's confronted by Nathan, and then David says, I have sinned against the Lord. And Nathan replies, the Lord has taken away your sin. And then he goes on to say, but the son born to you will die. And then I think right there is where I pick up at the beginning of Psalm 51, have mercy on me, O God, blah, blah, blah. So he's in all this despair, but it's like he missed the forgiveness part entirely. And here in Psalm 32, he's actually recognizing that God did that. I will confess my transgressions to the Lord, and you forgave the guilt of my sin. I don't know if I should read that as like a surprise or like a, like, I can't believe you did it because that sin was so great or what. I'm not exactly sure the tone that he's going for there, but he is acknowledging that forgiveness. And back in 2 Samuel and in Psalm 51, there doesn't seem to be any acknowledgement of that.
I mean, I think, if it had been, right, if Nathan said, well, your sin's been taken away, wouldn't it be a little bit strange if David were like, okay, cool, moving on?
Well, sure, sure.
Yeah. So I think there is like a, yes, your sin is taken away. You are already forgiven. And yet we, each person, like David, he's got to come to grips with that in his own way and in his own time. Mm-hmm. And he's not really going to come to grips with it unless he has to navigate the actual guilt,
the consequences,
despair, like you said, the consequences. You have to actually look those things in the face. So look at the word bones shows up in both of these psalms. So in Psalm 51, you get this. I'm going to read a section of two verses. Verses 8 and 15 says, let me hear joy and gladness. So imploring God, let me hear. So the subtext there is, I don't hear joy and gladness. I have no joy and gladness. And then he says, let the bones you have crushed rejoice. Open my lips, Lord, and my mouth will declare your praise. Then shifting to Psalm 32, verses 3 and 4, he says, when I kept silent, my bones wasted away through my groaning all day long. For day and night, your hand was heavy upon me. So I hear in Psalm 51, David is in the thick of it. And then I hear in Psalm 32, he is reflecting on that. And he's thinking about when I did keep silent, my bones were wasting away. But it's, notice the difference in the language. In Psalm 51, let the bones you have crushed rejoice. So that's an acute action, crushed, boom, you get crushed.
Yeah.
It happens. The wasting away, my bones wasted away, is something that happens kind of over time. And so I see David reflecting on this a little bit differently. And there is a recognition, I think, when he talks about whether the bones were crushed all at once or whether I just felt them wasting away as I was groaning. Either way, there is a recognition that God is not simply going to let sin slip out of his mind. It's not just going to happen automatically. That there is a need to acknowledge. There is a need, and the heavy hand is not there because God's a big meanie, but because the heavy hand is meant to help us get there, help get us to that point of acknowledgement. Because for us, I mean, think about it, Brent. How do you feel if you are if you are having something you're hiding and you're willingly doing it or you willingly done it, and then you imagine saying it out loud to somebody, what do you typically imagine that's going to be like?
It's this, it just never goes exactly how you think it's going to go. But it's like, you think you're not actually, either you think it's going to be way simpler than it actually is, or you think it's going to be wildly complicated and it's actually like, okay, thank you for saying that. That's all I needed to hear. But it seems like I can never guess which of the two it's going to be. I'm always the opposite.
But do you imagine whether it's going to be simpler or complicated? Do you imagine it's going to like be pleasant, or do you imagine it's going to be unpleasant?
I guess I try not to think about it too much, because if I think about it too much, then I probably will imagine it being unpleasant. And it's like, if I just hurry up and do it, maybe it won't be so bad.
Okay. Yes. That's interesting. So if I imagine doing it for too long, without just doing it, then probably what's going to happen is it's going to get harder and harder to do, because it seems like it looms larger and larger. It's like this monster that's growing and growing. It feels, I think, horrifying typically to think about, well, I'm going to have to say this thing and actually say to this person, I did this terrible thing against you, or whatever the thing is. But I think what this communicates with my bones wasted away when I kept silent, for however bad it's going to be to acknowledge it and say it out loud, it's way worse to not.
Yeah.
And that when we choose to move from silence to acknowledgement, so Psalm 32, when I kept silent, my bones wasted away. The next verse, then I acknowledged my sin. So we move from, I'm not saying anything, I've been crushed, to now I'm going to acknowledge it. I see a movement to then from this groaning, where he says, my bones wasted away through my groaning all day. It's like this unintelligible groaning to rejoicing. Psalm 51, let me hear joy and gladness. Let the bones you have crushed rejoice. So we move from a silence and an unintelligible groaning for as long as we maintain our silence to acknowledgement. And for as hard as we think that's going to be, what's on the other side of that is actually not regret. It is rejoicing, because, of course, then we can begin to work on things. Then we can start the process of restoring.
I don't know if this is fair to try to mash these psalms into the timeline of 2 Samuel, because it's, you know, it's meant to be more poetic than that. But if I'm thinking about where these things happened, Nathan confronts him, and then David just immediately says, I have sinned against the Lord. And Nathan says, the Lord has taken away your sin. But I wonder if that's not actually, if he like just reflexively made that confession, but didn't actually come to the Lord about it. He just says it to Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. And apparently that's enough for God to take away his sin and not kill him. But then there's like this element of, so maybe Psalm 51 doesn't come immediately after that. Maybe Psalm 51 is a little bit later. Yeah, I don't know. The timeline of what's going on in 2 Samuel is, because he spends the entire 7 days, the child becomes sick, and then is sick for 7 days and then dies. And that entire 7 days, he is, he's fasting, he's praying, he's in sackcloth, he's lying on the ground, he's not sleeping, I guess, very much. So it's all a mess. But then after that, like, he gets up and worships, and I don't know. So I don't quite know how to.
I don't think we have to get too hung up on the specifics and say, well, was it day one of that week or day seven of that week?
Yeah, right.
Or maybe it was a month later, or maybe it was a year later. But I think it does, because of the things I was saying about the way the language is being used, the tone of the thing. It feels like as David is writing Psalm 51, he is still very close to the experience. He still is acutely feeling the pain, the grief, the guilt, and all of that.
Well, and not sleeping for a week and not eating for a week and just, you know, the despair of that. Like, I can see that time period fitting well with that language of, your hand was heavy on me. My strength was sapped. Like that works there. Groaning all day long, bones wasting away. Like that all fits there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it kind of seems like he's, but then he's also not silent necessarily because he's pleading with God to save the child.
Right. I mean, but I wonder too, if there's a way in which, you know, was David internally wasting away when before Nathan had said something to him?
Yeah.
When he knew what he had done and he had to be confronted. Like he didn't just come out and say, this is what I did.
Right. Yeah.
Nathan had to come to him. And I think on the point of Nathan pronouncing the forgiveness, it's like, well, yeah, but if our goal is not to just be people who have a forgiveness card and then take it with us and are like, right. Yep, I got forgiven. Here's my card. Look at this. Yep. But to actually become like whole, restored, functioning, rightly related people, then there is a process that we have to go through, like a process of repentance. Of actual work that has to be done when we have gravely, you know, injured or wronged somebody. And I mean, we've talked about this before on the show, but just saying, well, I'm sorry, and now I said it, and you can say I forgive you, and now we're ready to move on, is clearly like, that's a disaster. And that's been tried in many ways, in many different church circles, and it doesn't work. Like, there actually is work that has to be done.
Yep.
So I want to move on to one other thing that I think links these two psalms and shows that they're related. So you've got the evolution of the idea of hiding. You've got this mention of bones and of silence and of voicing and groaning and rejoicing. The one other thing I see. So in Psalm 51, in verse 12 and 13, so David is pleading with the Lord, restore to me the joy of your salvation. And he says, and then I will teach transgressors your ways so that sinners will turn back to you.
Mm.
Now, one more time, Brent, read verses 8 through 10 of Psalm 32.
I will instruct you and teach you in the way you should go. I will counsel you with my loving eye on you. Do not be like the horse or the mule, which have no understanding, but must be controlled by bit and bridle, or they will not come to you. Many are the woes of the wicked, but the Lord's unfailing love surrounds the one who trusts in him.
What does that passage sound like? It doesn't sound like it comes from Psalms. Where does it sound like it should come from? It
sounds more like a proverb.
Yes. Yeah, it sounds like a whole section of wisdom that comes from Proverbs. And so you see David in Psalm 51 saying, just restore to me, like restore me, and then I will teach people your ways. And then in Psalm 32, he is doing exactly that. I will instruct you and teach you in the way you should go. And here's what I have to say to you. And it's interesting what he says, isn't it? Don't be like the horse or the mule who have to be controlled by bit and bridle or they will not come to you. What do you think David is like when he's not confessing and Nathan has to force it out of him?
Yeah, exactly.
He's having to be controlled by bit and bridle. He's being led literally to the realization about his own self. Oh my gosh, I am the man.
Yeah, yeah.
He's not coming to that on his own. And so he's 32, he's reflecting on this experience. And he's like, here's what I learned and I want you to know the same thing so you don't make the same mistakes I did. And he says, many are the woes of the wicked, but the Lord's unfailing love surrounds the one who trusts in him. Trusting in God does not mean that you never do a thing wrong. Trusting in God does not mean that you always do the right thing. I think trusting in God is saying, okay, in this case, I have done a terrible thing, but I'm not going to be the one to try to do all of the damage control. I'm not going to try to keep all of the plates spinning. I'm not going to maintain this house of cards that's going to collapse at any second by all the different things I'm saying to different people. I am going to trust in God by saying, yeah, I did this. This was me. I want to say, too, just really quickly, there's a danger here. If you just read Psalm 51, then I will teach transgressors your ways. There's a danger of being kind of too utilitarian about our sin, or like wanting to make it a prop where you skip over the actual confrontation that your soul needs.
Mm.
Just be like, okay, well, I can use this now. I can use this for some good purpose. The reason why we acknowledge our sin and the reason why we have to come to grips with it is not just so that we can turn around and use it. It's because that is essential for God being able to actually restore us, to make us whole. That's what we're about. And then going out of that, there comes a time where you are then able to teach from that, from the experience you learned. But it robs it of its genuineness, I think, and of its real power if it's like, oh, yeah, I did this yesterday and I felt sorry. But now today I'm going to be the one to like stand up and be an example.
Yeah,
might be a little premature.
Yeah, that like reflexive use of like, oh, God works all things for good.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, well, wait a second.
Yep,
we gotta do some more work before we're gonna realize that goodness.
Yeah. So seeing these, I guess, these common elements in the Psalms, and also recognizing that there is, I think, a real evolution in them. There is a real arc. There is a progress. I think that Psalm 32 does also come out of the Bathsheba and Uriah story, but I'm imagining it coming much, much later. And it's interesting to think, you know, a story like this, like Bathsheba and Uriah, if you're David, that's a story that's going to stick with you all your life. That's not going to go away. That is a central episode in your life. But notice how, if what I'm saying is right, notice how David has allowed himself, one, first just to grieve it, to feel the depth of it, but not to wallow there forever, but to learn from it and to grow. Like, I imagine David as a much older man writing Psalm 32, now reflecting on the effects of when he was keeping silent, now remembering that very difficult but really very good rebuke that he got from Nathan, that gift, and then recalling the healing that happened when he confessed, when he says, then I acknowledged my sin in Psalm 32, which even could be pointing directly at Psalm 51. This is how I was acknowledging it,
yeah,
was through that other psalm. And I think that Psalms 139 and 51 and 32, if we take them together in this timeline that I'm constructing, I think it shows this arc of a life that is moving through a monumental and self-imposed disaster, but that is determined to always be honest about it and also determined to remain oriented around God no matter what. Guilty or innocent, disoriented, oriented, hopeful, doubting, confused, whatever, there is this determination to keep God as the central object of the life, as the one against whom I have sinned, the one who is going to restore me, the one whose ways I am going to teach.
Yeah, I'm looking at verses 1 and 2, and those feel like, I mean, it's simple. It's like, yeah, sure, of course. Blessed is the one whose transgressions are forgiven, whose sins are covered. Blessed is the one whose sin the Lord does not count against them. But I feel like David is speaking about himself when he says that.
Yes, yes.
And there's just like this deep gratitude and wisdom in those first couple of verses.
Yes.
So Psalm 32, a psalm of new orientation?
I think so. I want to point out just a couple of this. We're almost done. I want to point out a couple of things that just observations, a sort of quick bullet point of things we can learn from this and from these psalms. One is that disorientation can be caused by external things outside of us, the world collapsing. Think Psalm 137 that we did with El.
Yeah.
We were carted off to Babylon. The whole world fell apart. But this also shows that I think disorientation can be self-imposed, self-created. Our own, you know, proclivity for getting into trouble and making a mess of things can make us very disoriented in the world and with God. Another thing is that our relationship to our own failures really can change over time, but that doesn't happen automatically. That doesn't just happen passively. Like, if I just live long enough, then eventually, like, time is going to take care of all of this. That there has to be acknowledgement. There has to be really working through it. But it really can change. The failures don't go away. I mean, those stories, that story is that story. And I think David, like I said, always remembered it. And some of us are going to have stories, you know, even failures, monumental disasters that we're always going to have as a part of us. But that our relationship to those things can change. And it can move from being a thing of immense despair to being a thing that says, I learned from this and God restored me. And now I can teach something out of this and something good can come of it. I also want to point out that our own relationship to God can also really change over time. Think about the hiding, that it really is possible to go from, and for people who are like in the throes of it, it's like, God, don't look at me. I never want to talk to you again. I never want you to see me ever again. Right. And it can feel like that's never going to change.
Yeah.
Like God's hand is always going to be heavy upon me. It's always going to feel like I'm being crushed. And yet it really can change through these same kinds of processes to where God becomes the one in whom you are hiding your whole self.
And I think Psalm 32 reflects that a little bit in verse 4. Like, day and night, your hand was heavy on me. My strength was sapped as in the heat of summer. But then summer gives way to fall. It's just a season.
Boom, Brent. Yes, that's beautiful. I did not think about that. Yes, it is a season. And it does change. And it turns into pleasant weather where, man, the whole world is beautiful. And where, if you live where I live, the leaves are changing. It's the best time to be outside is when it's starting to get colder and it's not so hot anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man. Thank you for pointing that out. That's great. I also want to point out the obvious, that confession is very hard. David didn't want to say it. Nathan had to confront him.
Yeah.
But that hiding actually is harder and more destructive. It requires more energy and more depleting energy over a long period of time to keep things silent, to keep things hidden, to keep things in the dark. And that the effects to our own selves, we're the ones who are wasting away when we don't say anything, when we don't bring it up. And the last thing that I want to point out is just that God wants to use our redeemed brokenness, not pretend like it never happened. God is not interested in taking that monumental failure and wiping it out from the record of your life as if it never happened. And again, I know all the verses about as far as the east is from the west. And yes, amen. Yes and amen, and thank God. But what I'm saying is that think about the way that he says, create in me a new heart, a pure heart is what he says. I can become something new. This thing is still a part of my story. And actually, if you do that, I can teach. And then he does teach. And he says, don't be like me. Don't be like a mule that has to be bridled, that has to be suckered into acknowledging his own guilt. But instead, trust God. And he says in Psalm 51, he says, I will teach transgressors your ways, so that sinners will turn back to you. This becomes a thing that is for the good of the community, so that anyone around me might be restored to God. It's not just about me. And so God wants to use that brokenness that has been redeemed, does not want to sweep it under the rug, and so we don't need to sweep it under the rug either. And that is Psalm 32 and 139 and 51.
Oh, man. I wish that they were more clearly labeled like Psalm 51 so that we could really know. But if this is not about it, then I don't know what's going on.
Right.
Because it fits so well.
It is what I see, who really knows. And yeah, I mean, I'd like to think about it this way though. One thing that I have for further study, if anybody's interested, there was a whole section that I thought about doing there are three different words that show up for sin and iniquity and transgression in this psalm. And they're not always, like, sometimes the word that is, for iniquity, it's like, it's translated as iniquity in one place in the English, but in another place in the same song, it's translated as sin. I think it'd be helpful if they just use the same word uniformly, because there are three different Hebrew words for it. It's instructive to explore a little bit about what those differences are. What I like about this psalm and in Psalm 51 as well is that all of them are covered. Like, the whole gamut is covered, whether we're talking about you know, missing the mark, or whether we're talking about a certain kind of crookedness or bent out of shapeness, whether we're talking about actively violating somebody's trust. There are different words for those, but they're all covered. But I would just point people to the Bible Project has a really great video series on this. They call it the Bad Words series. And there are three videos that cover these three different Hebrew terms. And I just found them really helpful for bringing a lot more color to what it is that David is writing about in these Psalms. So I would point people to that.
Okay. And then did you have a theory now that we've gone through this and analyze this on what maskil might mean?
Well, so far as I don't know, you know, I don't get all the linguistics and stuff, but as so far, Altered in his footnote points out that it could be related to giving instruction. And that makes sense to me here. It's like, I've gained this wisdom from experience and I want to turn it into something for you. And so then you get that very explicitly in verse 8, I will instruct you and teach you in the way you should go. Mm. And then he gives his teaching from there, his wisdom from there. So I would say if there is some linguistic cause for saying that this could be about giving instruction, I would say it's one of those. It's an educational song. It's an instructive song. It's a wisdom song.
Okay.
Yeah.
That does it for this episode then, I suppose. Mm. I think next week we're going to talk about Psalm 19.
Oh, yeah.
Which even that, there were like a few little mentions of things today that made me think of that. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so the Psalms.
I'm excited. Brent's going to be in the driver's seat for that one. So get ready, everybody.
Okay, well, in the meantime, you can go to BamaDiscipleship.com to find the show notes. Check out that Bible Project series. Sounds like that would be a good one. I have not seen that one myself, so I may have to do that as well. But you can use the contact page on the website to get in touch with us. That's the best and most up-to-date way. We'll be on that page. So thanks for joining us on the Bama Podcast. We'll talk to you again soon.